Okay, welcome to another edition of the Fertility Answers podcast. I'm your host, Neil Chappell. Excited to have our PA here with us today, Grace Pitt, to talk about more of what we do with the preliminary workup in patients that are coming interested in finding out more about their fertility. Think way back when to when we did our first podcast. We talked about what to expect in that first visit, and we touched a little bit on things like AMH to test egg reserve, semen analysis to test sperm, and the hysterosalpingogram, or HSG for short, often called the dye test. We talked a little bit about the fact that those are things that we do, but we haven't really gone into much detail about what they are. And I've gotten some feedback over the past few weeks to months about talking a little bit more about those tests and kind of what preliminarily they mean and how we think about them. So I thought this would be an appropriate time at the beginning of this year of 2021 to kind of go into that and help frame what we think about when we run those tests. So Grace, thanks for giving me some of your Friday afternoon to talk.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
Yep. Podcast, meet Grace. Grace, meet podcast.
Hello, world.
So whenever you and I, or you or I, sit down, we talk to a patient, one of the first things we always say is three things we care about: eggs, sperm, and uterus. Mm-hmm. And I always start with eggs. I know you start with sperm. But frankly, we've done a podcast on sperm. So honestly, I'm going to bypass sperm entirely today. If you would like to learn more about the semen analysis, we do talk about that in a prior episode. I'd encourage you to jump back over there and listen to that one. So today we're just going to focus on eggs and uterus. Let's talk a little bit about eggs. What do you tell folks about eggs in relationship to AMH?
Yeah, so with AMH, typically the way I talk to patients about it is every follicle that wakes up in any given month makes a little bit of this AMH. And the more AMH they kind of are expressing, the higher that level is, the more eggs they've woken up that month. And the more eggs they've woken up that month, you can kind of apply and guesstimate a general number of eggs they have kind of in their egg bank, so to speak, because women are born with all the eggs that they'll ever have. And so that number typically doesn't ever increase. It can only go down. And so looking at something like AMH gives us a good idea of kind of timeline and treatment options and what type of medicines would work best for any given patient. And so it's a really helpful number to kind of have in our arsenal before any type of treatment begins.
Yeah, I think that's perfect. That's exactly what I tell folks, is that Mother Nature designed the system kind of weird. You're born with all the eggs that you have, and therefore egg number slowly declines over time. And AMH is a helpful number to look at because each of the eggs that wakes up from hibernation makes a little bit of AMH. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that the number itself can tell us more than just egg reserve. It helps us understand medications. It helps us understand timeline. I think that's the really important subtle implications of AMH that patients should definitely have a grasp of and understand, just to have a good context of what it means when they check their AMH. Not just, oh, my egg account, my egg bank account is high or low or normal, but more so, how else can it inform? What do you say to folks when they have an AMH that's maybe a little bit lower than expected?
You know, if an AMH comes back a little bit lower than maybe we had anticipated, being as otherwise young and healthy as they are, I typically tend to not be too discouraged. I like to inform them that just because their AMH is low, that does not mean that they don't have eggs. It just means perhaps this month or in general, it's just a little bit lower than average. But there's still certainly options, and it doesn't really change too much. It helps us move forward with the best treatment path from that point on. It gives us that information we need as to whether or not we do need to be more aggressive with treatment moving forward more quickly through type of options. Typically 1 to 3 IUIs is first line treatment, but perhaps we move forward faster through those. Maybe it's just 1 to 2.
Depending on where they've been and how long they've
been trying. Correct. How long have they been trying?
It's all about context.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, having a lower AMH doesn't mean you don't wake eggs up. It means there are some eggs there, and with forms of treatment like IUI, we are just looking for one egg. So it doesn't change the fact that, or the success rate, so to speak, with
per cycle.
Yeah. It's just gives us that timeline and how aggressive we need to be and how soon we need to transition to other options.
And I think that's the scariest thing that people hear is my AMH is low. That means my eggs are dead. My eggs are bad. My eggs are gone. And the honest answer is that's not exactly what it means. It just means that in a given month, you're waking up less eggs than someone with a higher AMH. And so you're exactly right. It does not affect your chance to get pregnant month to month. There have been studies that have looked at patients that have lower AMHs. The pregnancy rates in a lower AMH are similar to the pregnancy rates of another AMH as long as you're ovulating. So, you know, I tell patients this, I don't care if you're waking up 3 eggs or 30 eggs, if you're ovulating an egg that month, you've got the same chance to get pregnant. Now, it does color in a little bit about our chances for success in an IVF cycle, because with IUIs or intrauterine insemination, or where we're helping someone ovulate and then time ovulation with insemination, kind of more natural cycle treatments, where we're just using the menstrual cycle to optimize natural fertility, we are only trying to release one egg. So again, I don't care if you wake up 3 eggs or 30, we're just trying to release one. With in vitro fertilization, IVF, we're trying to get as many as we can. A lower AMH means we're getting less eggs, and so maybe we have less of a chance for success there. But long story short, like you said, a low AMH is information that says, hey, we need to think about and be intentional about our timeline, but it does not mean that your eggs are of different quality or poor quality, and it certainly does not necessarily automatically mean that all your eggs are dead. It just means, hey, you wake up less eggs month to month. Let's be very intentional about how we use each month to make sure we get you pregnant as fast and as efficiently as possible.
Right. I always say with patients, you know, there's two sides of the egg coin, so to speak, when you're talking about eggs. There's quality and there's quantity. And so the quantity, the number, is that AMH. And so quality is something totally unrelated. So,
yeah.
Whether it is the 2 eggs or 20 eggs, it's quality is the other side of that coin. You have to take both into consideration. Yeah.
And most of the studies agree that egg quality is not correlated with AMH. There was one study that showed that folks that have a very low AMH may have a slightly higher risk for miscarriage if they conceive. But for the most part, I think the safe message is that AMH does not really do a great job of predicting egg quality or pregnancy rate month to month. It just tells us how many eggs you got. From an egg quality standpoint, like we talked about in some of those first few podcasts, egg quality is pretty much linked to your birthday, how young you are. And so that's something that we can immediately infer some information about and always talk about from the first visit onward. And okay, skipping over the normal AMH, because normal AMH just means you have good egg reserve. What about a high AMH? Does that give you any other thoughts or indications?
So high AMH is kind of depending on how high, in my opinion, because if it's kind of upper level normal or maybe a few points above normal, perhaps it's leaning towards something more like PCOS, where your ovary is waking up lots of follicles a month, or perhaps you just wake up a lot of follicles. That's absolutely an option as well. Once it does get up kind of into double digits or something like that, I definitely do lean toward thinking more along the PCOS pathway, whether it's lean PCO or kind of classic. That just tells me that most likely ovaries may be a little bit stubborn to any type of treatment. So I like to keep an eye on those when it comes to giving the medicines and following up scans and treatments pathways like that.
That's perfect. So we don't have enough research out there that says that AMH is a, quote, diagnostic criteria for PCOS, but to some degree it is a predictor. And it makes total sense, because one of the hallmarks of polycystic ovary syndrome, or PCOS, is polycystic ovaries, multiple cysts in the ovaries, which means you're waking up a bunch of eggs. As we've already said, eggs that wake up make a bunch of AMH. So if you've got a bunch of AMH, you've got a bunch of eggs, and that's one of the hallmark symptoms of PCOS. But you can also have a high AMH and just be, you know, good for you. You've got a lot of eggs. Way to go. So sometimes you just make a lot of eggs, and that's totally fine. But it can be indicative of, and so it's something you need to pay attention to. It could be PCOS. And you're right. Actually, AMH is a really useful hormone that's made by the eggs that wake up to kind of blunt the response of the eggs around it to stimulation. So AMH is one of Mother Nature's ways to select for a single egg to ovulate. So an egg makes AMH, it's kind of like saying, hey, I want to be the one that ovulates, everybody else chill out. By having a bunch of eggs make a bunch of AMH, you've got an ovary that has a lot of eggs that are competing with each other. That inherently makes them more difficult to stimulate. And more difficult to stimulate means it's harder to do things like ovulation induction with letrozole or Clomid or even injections. And you're right, when you have an AMH that's 10, 20, 30, 50, those are really high. That's a lot of noise. Those patients are at a higher risk of not responding to traditional stimulation methods for ovulation. And they may need to think about IVF sooner than later so that we can, in a controlled fashion, grow up multiple eggs, take them out of the ovary, and avoid the risk of triplets and quadruplets, etc., but still give them very, very good pregnancy rates. So yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think that covers the high, medium, and lows of AMH, and I don't know that there's much else to cover short of just saying that there is some variation cycle to cycle, but there's not much. Birth control pills can suppress your AMH to a certain degree too. And you may get some variability if you do one AMH assay with one lab and then maybe recheck it with another lab. Those are things to keep in mind whenever you're getting your AMH drawn with your physician or with a third-party company, just as far as things to think about when you have that number in the context of your own story. Again, skipping past semen analysis, let's talk a little bit about the HSG.
Yeah, the HSG. So basically, when I talk to patients about the HSG, I say, you know, we need to check on uterus, kind of uterus / tubes, because when it comes to types of treatment such as both intercourse and IUI, intrauterine insemination, the tubes play a really important role. They're actually a really, really important two-way highway because the sperm does need to travel down the tube to the site of ovulation. Then after fertilization has occurred, that fertilized embryo does need to travel back down the tube and to implant into the endometrium. And so that is a really important two-way highway, that if that highway is out or that bridge is broken or cannot be crossed, those type of treatment methods are not as effective, and we wouldn't want to waste anybody's time with anything that doesn't have a chance of working. And so doing the HSG really gives us a lot of information as to possibilities of things being inside the uterine cavity that we may be able to pick up, as well as, you know, patency of tubes.
Yeah, that's what I tell everybody as well, is that it's a good, quick 2 to 5 minute test that lets you know the cavity looks good, where the embryo is ultimately going to try and land, and that the tubes are open. And both of those things we need to know before going forward with treatment, because if there's not the case, which I would say we find something not infrequently, it's worth looking, but if we find something, we need to address that first. And then I do find anecdotally and through some research some other potential benefits to the HSG. Anything else that you mentioned to your patients when you're talking to them about it?
There does kind of, like you mentioned, come a little bit of boost with chances of pregnancy afterwards, something about kind of blessing the uterus, as you like to term it. You kind of bless the uterus and flush out the tubes, and pregnancy rates do tend to be a little bit higher afterwards.
A little higher. It's not very robust, but it is slightly higher.
Right.
The fallopian tubes are lined with tiny hair cells called cilia, and their job is to help transport the sperm down and the embryo back. And if they have a little bit of menstrual debris or mucus plug or something that's affecting their function, it does make it more difficult for the transport to occur. The flushing of the system, they move more efficiently. Pregnancy rates are slightly higher after having it done for the first few months following. So I think it's great to make sure that we're doing the right thing. Like you said, they're in the right treatment plan. They don't need some sort of intervention prior to going through treatment, but also just to get an extra boost. So why don't you just do like a 2 or 3 minute walkthrough of what the 2 to 3 minute HSG test actually looks like?
Yeah, of course. So we'll use a small catheter to go through the cervix into the uterus directly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
After blowing up a small balloon, we will push a little bit of dye, typically about a teaspoon of dye or so. And then using a fluoroscopy machine or kind of an x-ray machine, we'll be able to pick up that dye and watch it as it fills the uterus and then actually spills on out the tubes and into the cavity. And so it is very quick, pretty simple. It does tend to be a little bit crampy sometimes for patients. That tends to be kind of the biggest complaint. But it is so important to be able to see those tubes and know what's going on.
Do you do it under anesthesia?
I don't, no. So typically a little bit of over-the-counter NSAID medicine about an hour before the procedure is all patients really need.
Yeah. And 2 or 3 Advil or Aleve or something like that. Yeah, that tends to be all you need, yeah. It is a very simple, straightforward test. It is very informative. It is potentially therapeutic in that it helps get folks pregnant, and risks are minimal. The risk of infection is less than 1%. That is to say, if you do see evidence of a damaged tube, that risk does go up because you can have bad bugs hanging out in the tube. But as a standard precaution, and most fertility clinics will do this, but as a standard precaution, we do give antibiotics before and after the procedure to make sure that everything is covered just in case, because the tubes are very precious. We want to minimize any risk to them. Risk of bleeding, pretty minimal, and risk of damage to the uterus is exceedingly minimal. So it's a very safe, quick, and informative procedure that is pretty standard of care for most folks that have been trying for a while and need to find out what's going on. But yeah, I think that's a reasonable introduction to AMH and HSG. Semen analysis is in a prior podcast. And also, I didn't mention it earlier, but we talked a little bit about PCOS. PCOS has its own podcast earlier too, if you want to check that out. But I think this has been a good follow-up for that first introduction to what an REI visit looks like. I appreciate your time, Grace, and let's head off and finish off our plans for the day.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah. Bye.